Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, November 16th, 2025, and this is episode 22 of The Rift. There are almost 140,000 miles of freight railways in the United States, and those rail lines stand to be an important part of the fight against climate change. Electrifying trains is much more straightforward than electrifying long-haul truck routes, and they're significantly more efficient in terms of cargo capacity. But the American railroad industry is in conflict. Corporate consolidation and profit extraction among rail carriers threatens both the workers who make the industry run and the potential for rail to be a positive for climate mitigation. And I'm going to keep this intro really short because for today's show, I spoke to two people who had quite a lot to say about it. My guests today are Ron Kamenko and Nick Wurst, two railroad workers and members of Railroad Workers United, a solidarity caucus of rail workers that brings together members of unions across the rail industry. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about the state of rail workers, the fight against corporate mergers, and how rail workers can contribute to a just transition. But first, programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Plant Mode in downtown Champaign. Since 2013, Plant Mode has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical and succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records, and local-made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, and rolling pins. Plant Mode, now at 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram and on plantmode.com. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. November at Krannert Center features East Meets West Fusion with Sonny Jane's Wild Wild East on November 20th. Complete information is available at krannertcenter.com. And now, here's my conversation with Ron Kamenko and Nick Wurst of Railroad Workers United. I'm joined now by Ron Kamenko and Nick Wurst of Railroad Workers United. Ron and Nick, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Cool. So just to start out, could you just each sort of introduce yourself and say, you know, where you're calling in from and what you do on the railroads?
Well, I guess I'll go first, jump into the silence. So I'm Nick Wurst. I'm from Worcester, Massachusetts. I work as mostly a locomotive engineer now, but I've worked in the past as a freight conductor and also an intermodal worker for Class 1 freight railroad operations. And I'm a member of obviously, Railroad Workers United, but then I'm also a member of my individual union, SMART TD, International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, Transportation Workers, the Transportation Division, the union formerly known as the UTU.
And I'm Ron Kamenko, longtime member of Railroad Workers United. I served as the General Secretary for many years before Nick. I now serve the organization as a trustee on the Media Outreach Committee. And I hired out with Conrail in Chicago, a freight railroad that no longer exists because it was gobbled up in a big giant merger in 1999. So I then worked for the Norfolk Southern. I took leave of Norfolk Southern, then worked for Amtrak. And throughout my career, I worked first as a brakeman, then conductor, and then locomotive engineer. I just retired a couple of years ago.
Great. Well, thank you both for taking the time. And Just to kind of set the stage, could you explain what Railroad Workers United is and how this group came to be?
Well, Ron may be the one for how we came to be, because he was there. I come into the picture a lot later. Well, maybe not a lot later. So Railroad Workers United is an organization that's aiming to unite rank and file railroad workers from all of the various different crafts and from all of the various different unions. So in the U.S., railroad workers are, depending on how you, what you consider a union and what's, you know, folded into another union and things like that, we're divided up into about a dozen different unions, mostly along craft lines. It's this really sort of old school mindset. And so RWU sort of takes the position that we would be better served working together in solidarity, that railroad workers of all crafts share more in common in terms of our interests than we have individual. And so the best way to fight for our jobs and really a railroad system that works not just for all of us as the workers, but society at large is, you know, through craft unity, through rank and file power, and through, you know, badass union labor, or pardon the French, really, really tough, awesome union labor. Don't swear.
And I would echo what Brother Nick has to say, having been there at the beginning. The glaring contradiction between having a series of unions representing workers in the same industry becomes readily apparent to most railroad workers not too long into their careers, and they quickly understand that there's a sort of a weakness and impotence to having all these different unions that don't stick together, curry favor with the boss, and literally stab each other in the back, and do have a long history of scabbing. I know that might sound offensive to some railroad workers, but it is true. It's called union scabbing. And this came to a head in 2004, 2005, when it became obvious that the rail carriers wanted to run all of these freight trains with a single person. And that's when the contradictions become glaring. We need a union that can unite engineers and conductors, engineers and trainmen, as opposed to two separate unions that have us basically, you know, begging for crumbs, who's going to be the, quote, last man standing. And so to prevent a war between the BLE and the UTU, the two unions of the operating crafts, we formed a group called Railroad Operating Crafts United in 2005. And by 2008, that had morphed into Railroad Workers United, from the basic understanding that you need all of the union brothers and sisters in the rail industry under one big tent. And so that's been our project basically for a generation now.
And so broadly speaking, what's it like being a rail worker today? I guess, you know, Ron, you just retired, but what are the primary issues that you feel you guys are facing in your day-to-day right now?
Oh boy, where to start? So I guess I can jump in with this, and Ron can probably fill in a bunch of blanks that I inevitably miss. But I think if people want to really get a good sense of what are the sort of primary issues that we face, a good way to start is to look back at the almost strike in 2022, because I think the thing that started getting the term that started to be used as like an all-encompassing thing in the media, and, you know, we were using it ourselves to a certain degree, was sort of quality of life issues. So I think when we talk about issues that we're facing, we can break them down into sort of like immediate ones and then more long-term ones, sort of day-to-day stuff and then stuff that sort of poses a threat over the long term for the future of the industry and the workforce. So on a day-to-day basis, I mean, most railroad workers work under conditions where they are a lot of us are on call, 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. A lot of us are working in conditions where previously there used to be a lot more people, whether that's sort of in the operating crafts, where even as recent as earlier this year, some of the major railroads were still using 3 people on a train crew, and now they're down to 2, but also in the general sense of, you know, there basically used to be more train crews to handle all the freight, and there used to be more trains being run. All that's been downsized, so there's understaffing issues. It's really bad in the shop crafts, sort of machinists, car inspectors, people who work on maintaining the rail cars and the engines, and then also maintenance of way, people who work on maintaining the tracks and the facilities and things like that. Everything's been cut back to the point where, you know, everybody's got way too much to do and not enough time to do it. And, you know, on top of that, they're always trying to cut the overtime and things like that. So things pile up really quickly, and any sort of individual day when anything goes wrong on the railroad sort of cascades. So that's on sort of like the day-to-day basis. Those conditions create all kinds of safety issues. The being on call all the time, working all hours, working long shifts, being put up in crappy hotels at away-from-home terminals, things like that, that also puts a major toll on your mental health, on your family situation, on your physical health. You know, it's not conducive to being able to have like a healthy diet and things like that. And so that's all sort of like immediate stuff. So that's why we see people, you know, losing their jobs through furloughs and cuts, and people getting hurt or killed through sort of unsafe conditions, through having too much work to do, not enough people to do it, too much pressure from above. But then also sort of in the long term, that's why we see people getting sick and dying. You know, there's the sort of morbid joke, you know, railroad workers don't live past 65. You retire and then you die a couple years later. Hopefully not in the case of Ron. But then there's the, and I'll try to wrap up on this, there's the like long-term stuff, like everything I was mentioning about the cutbacks, and what Ron was actually mentioning earlier about sort of like the craft unions, and whether they really do the job of protecting individual crafts, is we've seen whole crafts disappear. You know, brakemen, the last brakemen are on their way out, the firemen are long gone, you know, they're trying to... The carriers are lobbying for obviously the one person crew that'll threaten either the conductor or the engineer craft in the long term. But then they're also lobbying for greater use of automated track inspection that'll threaten lots of maintenance of way jobs in the long term. So, and just in general, the network is moving less freight now than it was, you know, 20, 25 years ago. And so there's this sort of long-term concern that we seem to be in sort of a long, slow decline of the industry, and crafts are disappearing, jobs are disappearing. And so there's sort of the question of what kind of future is there for railroad workers who are just getting in now?
I would just jump in and add a few things. Not working in the industry at the moment, I can't speak to the day-to-day issues, but what we have seen over time is the erosion of the workforce. We had 2 million railroaders in this country at one point, and probably half the population. So if you do the math, per capita, we had 20 times more railroaders, and everybody had a brother, cousin, sister, father, uncle, great-grandfather in the rail industry, and that just isn't the case anymore. Probably combined freight and passenger service, commuter, we have under 200,000, so 90% of us don't exist. And, of course, the rail industry, just like most industries, has almost fetishized the elimination of workers. And that is one of the ways that they see they can maintain profitability. And so, for example, this merger with UPNS is not a proposal to like, hey, we're going to get trucks off the highway and we're going to be moving all this additional freight and that's how we're going to make more money. The rail industry is not really interested in moving additional freight. They're interested in cutting costs. And one of the big ways you cut costs is get rid of workers. And so now with AI, you can look for, you know, an increased pressure to reduce the workforce. If this merger goes through, there will be what they call redundancies, and we'll probably see all sorts of diesel shop closures, car shop closures, hump yard closures. This has been the history of mergers. And so it's about eliminating labor. And so that's an issue that's always lurking in the background over our shoulder. You know, will our seniority carry us onward to a better position in our hometown, or will we have to chase our seniority 500 miles away to maintain our jobs because of the reduction in employment? And what the carriers can't eliminate through new technology, artificial intelligence, and so forth, they're always looking for ways to contract this out so that they don't actually employ you. And for railroad workers, when you're not employed by the railroad, that means you don't fall under the Railway Labor Act. There's a good chance when you're contracted out, it won't be a union job. You will not be covered by railroad retirement, and the list goes on and on. And so the rail industry has a key interest. If we can't eliminate your job through implementation of new technology, we're going to try to contract it out. So there's all these pressures upon maintenance of the workforce. And this latest Union Pacific Norfolk Southern proposed merger is just, you know, one more example of how they aim to cut costs and cut labor in the process.
Yeah, so you guys both kind of painted a picture that I think we're hearing really from workers across industries, especially right since the Reagan era, really, in terms of attacks on labor, elimination of workers, austerity policies. And so amidst all of that, one of the major issues that you all are campaigning on, and Ron, you started to beat me to it, is the proposed merger between Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern, which are two of the largest North American rail carriers. So why are these mega mergers and, you know, corporate consolidation, potential rail monopolies, what threat specifically does that pose to rail workers?
Well, I think Ron basically covered most of it. I mean, the big thing to understand for people not familiar with the industry is that there's not that many railroads. The number of railroads has dropped because basically there's been consolidation, right? Fewer and fewer railroads owned by fewer and fewer hands. They've bought up smaller railroads, and so we're at the point now where there's really four big railroads in the U.S. at this point, and there's sort of two in the eastern half of the country and two in the western half of the country. And so Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern, Union Pacific's in the west, Norfolk Southern's in the east. If they merge, it's on a scale that we've never seen before. It would be the first sort of massive single transcontinental railroad. And it has a lot of dangers. Some of them are really tangible, like really concretely. Generally speaking, these railroads are meeting up at several points along sort of a north and south line in the country, you know, Chicago down to New Orleans. And in all of those areas, a lot of those are historically like railroad towns. These are cities where, you know, railroading has been a good career. It's, you know, it's where you can go without a college education. You get a job that pays relatively well. You get a pension, you know, you get good benefits. All of those locations, there's going to be Norfolk Southern facilities and Union Pacific facilities that are now sort of prime candidates for the companies to argue, or the newly formed, you know, merged company to argue that these are now redundant, right? So they're going to be looking at all of these cities and saying, all right, we've got a Union Pacific and a Norfolk Southern freight pool here. You know, we can get rid of one of them. We can combine the two. We've got two diesel shops in the area. We can close one of them. We've got, you know, two different hump yards. We can close one of them. And so they're going to take the opportunity to basically move a whole bunch of people and facilities sort of off the books, right? You know, slash those expenses in the interest of basically trying to boost profitability in the short term, which has been sort of the MO of the railroads over the last, well, really since the Staggers Act and deregulation. But so that's the sort of immediate thing, is all of these cities and all of these workforces are probably going to get devastated in terms of prospects for railroad workers. Like Ron said, you know, there might be some sort of agreement with the unions where, you know, you get to keep your seniority, but if they cut the number of jobs, you know, in order to exercise your seniority, you might be forced to move, you know, who knows, 500 miles away, whatever, and bump off someone else off of their job, and then they're going to get furloughed. But then also, I think there's going to be a knock-on effect of every time we've seen mergers, and this is even as recently as when Canadian Pacific bought Kansas City Southern, there are meltdowns, massive meltdowns in the network, where there's always huge problems with transitioning over. Ron can talk to this a lot, sort of having experienced the Conrail carve-up, but even just the most recent one with CPKCS, they run north and south basically, and they meet in like one area, as opposed to, you know, this proposed other merger, which would have multiple different locations where there's this interchange. And the computer cutover issues that they had caused, according to their own CEO, 3 months of backup on the railroad and congestion on the railroad. So that's goods that aren't getting delivered. That's key raw materials or products that aren't getting delivered. I mean, back during the crew shortage crisis in like 2021, you know, they were hauling the railroad CEOs in front of Congress and having them answer questions about sort of the service meltdown at that time was going to threaten like the viability of like harvesting, planting and harvesting season. And it was like threatening the viability of like being able to continue to purify water, because, you know, chemicals that are needed to do that are primarily transported by the railroad. So, I mean, it's all that plus, you know, it's more corporate power for more lobbying, for making negotiations tougher for union members. It's just, it's bad in any way you look.
Well, to paraphrase what Nick is saying, basically, I mean, if you look at it from a perspective of short term, medium term, and long term, this is not in the interest of railroad workers. In the short term, we have every reason to believe there will be what has been known in the industry as a meltdown, a massive service failure. And that's based on precedent. In 95, 96, Union Pacific took over Southern Pacific and made a royal mess of it. 3 years, 4 years later, Norfolk Southern took over, I think it was 42 or 58% of Conrail, and made a complete and total mess of it. And now, as Nick said, with Kansas City Southern, a very simple end-to-end merger at Kansas City, and they didn't do very well. This is going to be the biggest, most complicated rail merger in history. And so we have every reason to believe there'll be a massive service failure. And of course, who's called upon to pick up the pieces and move the trains and be completely fatigued and bear the brunt, the frontline workers. And so I would argue in the short run, we're really gambling with any kind of agreement with the rail carriers to support this merger. And then in the medium term, in the medium run, as we both have talked about, mergers are about consolidation and about eliminating what they like to call redundancies. And so that means most likely a diesel shop, a car shop, a classification yard in places like Kansas City, St. Louis, New Orleans, Memphis, Chicago, where the two railroads meet. There's plans, you can guarantee it, that they will be eliminated. And so that's not in the interest of railroad workers going forward. And then the other thing Nick talked about, in the long term, in the greater picture, this merger and those that will inevitably follow just consolidates the rail industry into fewer and fewer hands, which is, you know, never good for a society, for corporations to have such monopolies. I mean, you know, there was a board game invented 125 years ago or whatever about this, and it's just a spoof on a system that is prone towards monopoly, but that's the seeds of its own destruction, because monopoly is anti-democratic. It preys on the customers, it exploits them, and so forth. And we knew this back in the robber baron days, because the Interstate Commerce Commission was created and the railroads were the poster child for monopoly, and how it was had a terrible effect upon the economy and society. So here we are, ready to allow basically what inevitably will become two transcontinental railroads moving the vast majority of rail freight in this country that all industry is reliant upon. And a final thing that needs to be talked about too is it's not just a monopoly of that industry. They actually own the infrastructure. So it would be similar, I make the point, that if J.B. Hunt and UPS were to own the interstate highway system, because these railroad companies actually own the infrastructure, and not just in the United States, but between four of them, well, soon to be four if they get their way, or I should say five, actually, maybe soon to be four after that, just four or five companies will own the infrastructure largely of the entire continent, because they have their tentacles into Mexico, and the two Canadian roads own the infrastructure in Canada, just like the U.S. roads own it down here. And so it just sounds like a very, very bad idea for society and for the economy and everything else, for the rail industry for that matter. Not for the stockholders, it'll be good for them, but for railroading, it's probably not going to be good. And we maintain that it's a disaster for railroad workers to have our employers gain this much power.
Right. And, you know, amidst all of the things that this is going to be bad for, rail is perhaps one of the most environmentally friendly methods of shipping. And before we kind of get into the impacts, we've already talked about, you know, impacts on workers, impacts on the economy, impacts on the rail industry altogether. But this merger potentially has environmental impacts as well. And of course, on this show, that's kind of our reason for existing. But before we get into that, I'm curious, you know, if you could talk about why rail is one of the more environmentally friendly methods of shipping, and what role rail workers play in making that the case.
I should qualify this with I don't have a college degree in anything, let alone in any kind of environmental science. But it seems relatively straightforward to me. We can move like an unbelievable amount of tonnage on freight trains. I mean, and it's kind of it's kind of complicated. We have a complicated relationship with long and heavy trains, right? The longer and heavier a train is, the more dangerous it is to operate, the more catastrophic things will be when it goes wrong, the more difficult it is to operate. And also the more complicated it gets to sort of operate trains that are two, three times longer than they were you know, back when the sidings and the yards were actually built. So they don't really fit anywhere. But even sort of setting aside that, even sort of taking like a modest sized train in sort of like the modern context, I mean, you're talking about moving like 8,000 tons of stuff with, you know, three engines, two engines on some territory. I mean, it's kind of mind boggling, just how much stuff we're able to move. And I think there are a couple of things that I think is worth sort of qualifying this, because the railroads love to sort of market themselves as like the green, like alternative to trucking. And I mean, that is true. Like in the broad scheme of things, it's much better than trucking, to my understanding. But also, the railroads could be doing so much better, between things like phasing out older locomotives that don't meet emission standards, actually properly maintaining things like automatic start-stop systems on locomotives so that they aren't just idling 24/7, electrification. I mean, there's a great quote that we've turned up in some of our research from like back in, I think it's 1917, when the railroads were still under the control of the government under the U.S. Railway Administration, where there's a quote saying that electrification is no longer, there's no longer a technical obstacle to electrification, it's a financial one. So basically, you know, back in 1917, we had the tech to fully electrify the railways, but it's just a matter of spending money. So I think, yeah, it is so much better just by the very nature of just how much more weight we can move with a couple of locomotives than you can with trucks. Even setting aside sort of probably like the knock on benefits of, you know, less trucks means probably the less people stuck in traffic idling their cars, and things like that. It's just it's a different scale of moving freight.
I would add, you know, there's this element of physics. A steel wheel on a steel rail takes about the size of a dime, and a freight car has eight wheels. And so, you know, you're looking at actual friction, maybe the size of a silver dollar combined total. If you look at an 18-wheeler, it's got 18 rubber tires, and the amount of friction is enormous. And so one of the great advantages of trains is, of course, the whole idea of a train. You can put 100 of them together, and a train with 200 containers is not an outsized train. It's probably on average about a mile long, which is a pretty good size for a freight train. That's 200 containers that otherwise would be requiring 200 chassis, all with 18 rubber tires going down the highway. And from the environmental perspective of carbon emissions, it should be obvious that trains emit far less carbon emissions for a ton of freight moved. CSX used to like to actually have commercials on TV where they said we can move a ton of freight 450 miles or whatever on 1 gallon of fuel. And it's true. And the rail industry should be proud of its environmental capabilities. But ironically, here's the contradiction, which is the rail industry is moving far less freight than they did at a peak year in 2006. And so if the rail industry is so damn efficient and so capable of moving freight in an environmentally sensitive fashion, which I totally agree, it is. It has a potential for a vast solution to a lot of our environmental concerns. Why is the industry moving less freight? Well, they're moving less freight because they can actually do that and make more money. And it's back to the whole question of monopoly or duopoly or whatever you want to call it at this stage in history. And the irony there is We are squandering a national resource. So how do you move more freight? Well, the rail industry would have us believe you do that by shuttering hump yards, by laying off workers, by consolidating with other companies, when in fact, these are all Band-Aid solutions to keep the industry profitable on Wall Street. But in reality, they don't enable the movement of more freight. To enable the movement of more freight, you double track railroads. Most of our railroads in this country are single track. A railroad becomes four times more efficient once it has double track as opposed to single track. So you make a railroad more fluid, enable way more trains to traverse the territory when you double track it and you provide high speed crossovers, you maintain it properly, et cetera, et cetera. But the other thing, too, going forward into the future that makes railroads so incredibly efficient, as Nick talked about, is the prospects of electrification. And the rest of the world is forging ahead with electrification because you gain huge economies when you electrify and incredible environmental benefits. And one of them is regenerative braking. Every time a freight train that weighs 10,000 tons comes down a mountain or puts on the brakes to stop, just like your little hybrid car, regenerative braking kicks in. And that actually puts electricity back up into the wires to assist the next train coming up the mountain on the other side. And so electricity would really amplify the rail industry's efficiency. But of course, they have no interest in electrifying. They've made it clear they're not going to do it. It costs too much money. And Wall Street isn't interested in profits 20 or 30 years from now. They're interested in them next quarter. And so therefore, they're more interested in buying their own stock back rather than investing in double tracking, modernized signal systems, electrification, and all the rest. So, I mean, I could go on endlessly about that, but Roshan, for your interest, you might want to check out a group called Solutionary Rail, because this is their bag, is double tracking, electrification, reinstatement of a national passenger rail network that commingles with freight. These aren't high-speed fetishists who, you know, we got to have the latest shiny object of 250-mile-an-hour trains bulleting through the countryside on elevated structures. Just using conventional railroads, we were running trains 100 miles an hour 100 years ago, and now, you know, we're largely limited. Most freight trains don't go more than 70. Most passenger trains don't go more than 79. And, you know, this is just kind of unconscionable when you think about what the rail industry could become. It already is incredibly environmentally sensitive and efficient compared to airline and highway, but it could be so much more. But the current industry, the way it's structured privately, isn't going to take us there.
Yeah, and you brought up passenger rail, and I wanted to talk about that because I'm curious where that fits into all of this. You know, most people in the sort of climate activist or climate policy world, they do see passenger rail and expanding passenger rail as a necessity to, you know, get more cars out off the road, get more planes out of the sky, you know, move things in the direction of more efficient mass transit and electrification. So what's the relationship between passenger rail and, you know, you all working on these huge freight rail carriers?
So there's a huge fundamental problem to improving passenger service, which is exactly what Ron mentioned earlier. The vast majority of track in the United States is owned and dispatched by Class One freight railroads. Their primary interest is moving their own trains. Their primary interest is, you know, maintaining a track that lets them focus on, you know, high volume, high margin customers. Even though there are, you know, there are laws basically that require them to sort of give priority to Amtrak and to, you know, make their trackage available for passenger service, they, you know, they fight that tooth and nail all the time. And it's one thing to sort of have a law saying that they have to do that, and then there's another thing in terms of the day-to-day dispatching of the railroad. So, I mean, there's some insane statistics about the how the vast majority of delays to various Amtrak trains are ultimately down to freight operations. There's been big high-profile battles over not just Amtrak, but also sort of regional and local commuter services getting access to trackage rights owned by the class ones. And so if you're going to expand passenger rail, you have to do battle with the class one freight railroads, who basically have no interest in more passenger trains, faster passenger trains, more frequent service, or service to areas where it doesn't go right now. But then there's sort of a knock on, there's a secondary problem to that that I'll add, which is that you know, there's been some smoke around the idea about privatizing Amtrak, right? And then a lot of regional and local commuter services are sort of subcontracted out, where they might be sort of owned by the state or the municipality or something like that, but then their operations are contracted out. And there is a certain amount of business logic even to these public transportation quote unquote entities, right? There was with the threat of privatization around Amtrak, a lot of the unions were making the, you know, very good and correct point that if you privatize Amtrak, then there's no incentive to offer service to rural areas, to areas that aren't high margin, because you can do what the freight railroads have done with freight service and just drop small customers basically and focus on high margin ones. So there's also got to be sort of a grappling with how passenger service is being run, you know, making sure that Amtrak doesn't get privatized, making sure that other passenger operations don't get privatized. But so you've kind of got that issue tied up in all of this. And like what Ron was just saying, I mean, imagine how much better Amtrak service could get if we were double tracking, or even in some cases triple tracking, these big main lines where there's a ton of freight, but then there's also a high demand for passenger service. You know, it would be a much more fluid system. The real problem is Amtrak is, generally speaking, it's not necessarily cheaper and it's not necessarily faster than flying. I mean, you don't have to deal with TSA, which is awesome, right? But if you're gonna get more people to take passenger rail, it needs to be either cheaper or quicker, or ideally both, than flying or driving. Or more convenient, and it's not right now. And so there are those sort of big picture questions tied up in all of this. But yeah, I guess that's the relationship between passenger and freight, is generally speaking, passenger service gets treated like second class citizens on a network that's majority owned by the freight carriers.
Right. And I have to imagine that would get worse the more powerful and larger these freight carriers become. You know, what you were talking about, you know, dropping service in rural areas, it kind of reminds me of the whole reason that we had rural electrification and public electric co-ops back in the FDR era, specifically because the for-profit energy utilities saw no profit in going into these rural communities and getting them electrified. And that kind of brings me to my final question for you. And I know that, you know, public ownership is something that a lot of rail workers have started to just kind of come out and say as of late. But ultimately, I'm curious how you guys think a worker-led rail industry can just be better and potentially contribute to a just transition to a more sustainable society.
So Railroad Workers United, in the heat of the battle 3 years ago for our national master freight contract, adopted a resolution where we basically support public ownership of the nation's railroads. Private ownership has not worked, and I think the numbers say that. The lack of passenger trains, the dismal situation with freight, moving far less freight than we did a generation ago. And so public ownership did have a day during World War I for a few years, and railroad workers were almost unanimous in their support. There was a nationwide plebiscite, and railroad workers at that time voted on the order of 99.3% in favor of keeping the railroads publicly owned. It's a little known piece of history, and it was designed to be under something called the Plum Plan, where workers actually had a third of the votes on the boards of directors. And so we believe that, and you hear it all the time when you go to work, we know how to run the railroad. They don't, they being the managers. The situation has gotten much worse because in the old days you did have people who came up as brakemen and firemen and conductors and dispatchers who actually were the CEOs. But now, you know, they're Harvard-trained professional, certified public accountant types who've never actually railroaded. And so we believe that a public ownership with worker participation in the governance of the railroad would be far more efficient, far more shipper friendly, far more passenger friendly, and also would be interested not in buying back its own stock and not in paying exorbitant dividends to stockholders, but actually plowing the profits back into the industry in the physical plant and doing what needs to be done, which is double tracking, electrification, and all the rest, so that, as Nick was saying, we can run passenger trains at a higher speed and we can run them on time and we can have expanded frequencies and additional routes. All this talk about privatization of Amtrak is so much bunk. The railroads ran the passenger network in this country, and they ran it into the ground for the most part, and they didn't want it. You don't make money on passenger trains. They don't really make money anywhere in the world. And so this nonsensical idea that somehow private companies will run a passenger network profitably, efficiently, customer-focused, and all of that stuff in the United States is just so much drivel. Amtrak was created because the rail industry did not want passenger trains, could not run them, and were losing a large amount of money on them. I'd also make this point. As Nick was saying, it's hard to compete with the auto and airline, but that's because Amtrak has to assume much of its cost at the fare box. And everyone says, oh, Amtrak's losing money and it's not profitable. Well, the major airlines get a huge subsidy. They're subsidized every day because your ticket cost does not cover the cost of TSA inspection, of the air traffic controllers, and the building of the airports, the maintenance of the airports. So they are getting subsidized, and the true cost of an airline ticket and the true cost of driving your car down the highway is not reflected in the cost that you that the individual pays, because there's general taxation that is subsidizing both of these industries. I could talk about this forever, but I won't. But the reestablishment of passenger rail in this country is dependent upon the public. All over the world where passenger rail is forging ahead, it's being done because there's a federal commitment to building a passenger rail network out. It's not because private industry is doing it, and we need the same solution in this country.
Well, Ron and Nick, it's been such a fascinating conversation with you guys, and we're just about out of time here, but before I let you go, is there any way that people can kind of follow your work and anything that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, so we have a website, railroadworkersunited.org. There's also, on the public ownership question, there's an organization that we helped launch that we work with called Public Rail Now, and their website is publicrailnow.org. And I think your listeners would be really interested in the two excellent pieces of research that have been published there and are free to read and download by PDF. One is a white paper about sort of the history of publicly owned rail in the U.S., but also the current state of the railroads and also comparisons to international railroad models. One of the ones that always stands out to me from that is India. Sort of people always talk about the U.S. network as if it's unique as sort of like a big continent-wide freight primary network, and sort of the justification for why, you know, the European model doesn't work. But the Indian railways are publicly owned and they're electrifying big chunks of their freight operations, right? And then there's this other report that's called From Margins to Growth, which is an economic impact study, which includes a bunch of numbers in terms of environmental effects of what could be gained from public ownership of the railroads in the U.S. So both of those are available on publicrailnow.org. So yeah, I'd just add our website, the PRN website, and yeah, Ron already mentioned Solutionary Rail.
That's awesome. I'm excited to read those reports. I didn't know they existed, and I'm very
they're very
interested.
Good. Even I can make sense of them. That's how good they are.
Just a couple other things. When you go to the website, that we do have a quality e-newsletter. It comes out Tuesday morning, faithfully every Tuesday for the last 6 years or so. It covers the railroad news in the industry and what the rail unions are doing, also what RW is doing. A valuable resource. And if anybody out there is working on the railroad and wants to join, we're a membership-based organization. We also accept non-voting solidarity memberships from the public at large and other workers in other affiliated unions like Longshore and Trucking and so forth. So all that's available on the website.
Great. Well, it's been so great to talk with you guys, Ron Kamenkow and Nick Wurst of Railroad Workers United. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was my conversation with Ron Kamenko and Nick Wurst, railroad workers and members of Railroad Workers United. I'd like to thank both of them once again for sharing their wisdom and their experience and their fight. And as they mentioned, you can find out more about their work at railroadworkersunited.org. Now, we touched on this just a little bit near the end of our conversation, but I found so much in Ron and Nick's perspective that's so similar to the people that we've talked to in previous episodes of this show about public power. There's a real appetite for public ownership, but it doesn't stop there. It's a desire for true democratization of these institutions, whether it's rail or the grid or beyond. The idea that workers and community members should run these things such that they benefit the public rather than shareholders or CEOs. And although the conditions of rail workers might be quite different from those faced by utility workers or construction workers or service workers, I think that appetite represents an opportunity for people who want to build a broad movement around giving control back to normal people. And groups like Railroad Workers United are putting that into action. And broadly speaking, I think that that's kind of a lot of what we need in the fight, not just for climate justice, but for everything else. So that's today's show. And as always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or various aggregators of your choosing if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett, right at the top of the hour at 4 p.m. The next episode of The Rift will be on Sunday, December 7th. Until then, take care.
poor aching heart. Each night I suffer for your sake. You're the girl I love so deep. I wish that I was gone with you, or you were staying here. Wherein you might behold, oh, there your name lies rolled, my love in letters made of gold. In letters made of gold, my love, believe me when I say you are the one I will adore until to you, bright day be turned.